It's 10:20. House Special Committee on Economic Development, Tourism, and Trade. With us, joining us this morning, Representative Foster, my Vice Chair, Representative Olson, Bob Herron, and Representative Thompson, and a special guest in the room is Representative Fairclough. And please, Debbie, note for the record that the resources co-chairman from the Senate is joining us. Good morning, Joe. How are you doing?
Very good. Pleasure to be here. I'm interested in the topic and just want to pay attention to what's going on here. So,
well, yeah, as a little opening to that is that, you know, maybe some of the questions that Alaskans have about the closure will be answered today, and that in both houses, maybe there will be further dialogue in the respective energy, resources, and finance committees. And so we do have several people signed up, and we've invited several people. So the first person, Rob, could you cue up the Speaker of the House? The Speaker of the House is on travel status back to Washington, D.C. as we speak, and yesterday he has recorded a presentation. And so, Rob, please go ahead with Speaker of the House, Mike Schnall.
Mr. Chairman, first I would like to thank you and the committee for holding the hearing dealing with the loss of the Phillips Conoco LNG plant on the Kenai Peninsula. While I represent that area and know most of the individuals that are soon to lose their jobs at that facility, I just think that it's important that Alaskans know that this facility was one of the few value-added producers in this state and what kind of effect it has on our community. 30 to 60 high-paying jobs have been lost, and while we don't have complete control over it, I think it's imperative that we do everything we can to not allow other industries in this state to come just like the Phillips plant has and not be a contributing part of the state. So, you know, it's a big hit on our local community, not just the jobs that are associated with that, but also the taxes that the facility created, the money that ConocoPhillips and Marathon have put into the community, into different things like the Boys and Girls Club or into our schools or other entities throughout our community. And also it affects many parts of the community, all the way down to the electricity and how much is used in our community and what that eventual cost is going to be to replace that lost customer that our local utility had. So, Mr. Chairman, I once again appreciate you allowing me to be on here and talk with you via or video versus there in person. I would love to be there and listen to testimony that some of the people in the committee and others that you have that are going to testify before you. But I just I think it's a sad day in Alaska's history that we're losing a facility that has been a contributing factor to Alaska's growth for the last 40 some odd years, and it's just a sad day. So with that, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I thank you for allowing me to give you my testimony. Thanks.
Well, obviously we can't ask the speaker any questions, but another representative that represents people on the Kenai is a member of this committee, and so at this time I'd extend the opportunity for my vice chair, Kurt Olson, to share your thoughts on the local impact of this pending closure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always difficult following Speaker Chenault on oil and gas issues in Cook Inlet. He and his family have been involved in both the LNG plant and the Agrium plant that was shut down several years ago for probably the past 30 years. Unquestionably, his depth of knowledge is untouched in this building on Cook Inlet gas and oil. Having said that, we have kind of an interesting relationship between our two districts. Most of the people that work on the North Road, either at the plant or on the platforms, live in my district, even though the plants are physically outside of my district by about 10 miles. The speaker and I share a number of things like that, where the people live in one district, work in the other, shop in one, live in the other. So the impact is felt throughout the Central Peninsula. We were fortunate enough to have Click Bishop from the Department of Labor step up within 12 hours and offer the services. Unfortunately, most of them are related to the experience they developed off of the Agrium shutdown. We still have the Agrium transition office in Kenai that we're going to be able to utilize. I'd like to say we hadn't gone through the first experience and lost several hundred jobs, but we and the Department of Labor have learned from it and are ramped up. But what I will address is what I think the causes that led up to this are. Again, they're only my own. I haven't talked to the speaker about them. He probably shares most of them. There are probably people in this room that don't agree with me, but I would like to say there was one person or one thing that led up to the closure, but there weren't. There were a number of issues, starting with the failure several years ago to end a, or for ConocoPhillips and Marathon to get a 10-year extension of the export license. When they didn't get that, they were unable to have 10-year contracts. During the, I believe, 40 years that they've had Tokyo Electric as their main market, the contracts, to the best of my knowledge, up until recently, were always 10 years. So we lost that tool and that commitment. Yet on top of that, the worldwide glut of cheap gas and cheap LNG, starting with the shale gas in the lower 48 and ending up with all the gas that's either floating around the ocean right now looking for a new home or coming from a region where they basically have the ability to drill on the beach and put a real short pipeline in and export it without having the problems that we have or the expense, time and expense it takes to develop resources like in Cook Inlet. I heard from the AOGCC yesterday, and anybody in the room that was in the meeting will know that there is still gas and oil left in Cook Inlet. But when we opened up Prudhoe Bay, there was virtually no need for looking for it. In my neck of the woods, and I believe in Speaker Chenault's, the saying was that the people that found gas in Cook Inlet usually got fired because they were looking for oil. And the gas was a burden to them more than a benefit because it was truly stranded at that point in time. We didn't have the urea plant or we didn't have the export plant. But I believe there are probably people in the room that have much more knowledge than I do on those days in Cook Inlet. But the next thing, I think the RCA decisions on the approval of Cook Inlet gas contracts, some of them took up to, you know, sometimes it was a 5 to 7 year process, hamstrung people from coming in, particularly the new explorers, and looking for gas, knowing that it was going to take them years to get approval to put that gas under contract and make some money out of it. I think that added to it. And then the probably to a lesser degree, the disruption of the Cook Inlet gas market caused by the Agrium closure. They had the ability to take a good portion of the gas, at least in their later years, seasonally, and they would take most of it 9 or 10 months out of the year and not take it when we had the you know, the crunch, you know, basically a 6 week crunch in the middle of winter. So I'd like to say there was one issue that led to this, but it was at least those and probably more that I missed. But and again, I'm pleased and grateful for the help that we're getting out of the Department of Labor on this. And ultimately, I think this one will not quite have the impact on us that the fertilizer plant had on us, but it will trickle down onto the tax base. We're going to lose a significant amount of property taxes by the way that they tax these type of facilities. But again, I wish I could say it was one person or one thing that led to the closure, but it wasn't.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Before we open up to questions from committee members to the vice chair, a little bit of housekeeping. We've been joined by Representative Tuck, Representative Keller, Representative Munoz, and Representative Gardner to the committee. And the we do have our regular work that'll be later in the morning after this. The intent to go till between 11:50 and 11:30. If we have to run over, we'll run over. And we do have the room through the lunch hour, so we'll be able to get to film incentives as well. So the structure of this hearing is, of course, you've heard from our colleagues about the local impact. Then we're going to go to the Department of Labor and talk about how they're supporting the workers. Then we'll have the Conoco presentation, and then we'll have sort of the overarching discussion about South Central Energy Supply, and we'll, at that time, I'll call upon the RCA to be available. So at this time, before we go to the department, is there any questions for Representative Olson from the committee members?
Okay. Well, I got off easy.
Yeah, you did. Well, maybe they'll think of something here shortly. Okay, at this time, could we please have Tom Nelson come forward? And morning, sir. Please state your name, your title, and begin your presentation, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for asking the department to participate. And thank you, Representative Olson, for your kind words on our department. For the record, my name is Tom Nelson, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And we have been in contact with ConocoPhillips as well as two contractors that we know have interests in the LNG plant closure, both Peak and Udelhoven. We've developed a good working relationship with ConocoPhillips over the years as they've hired an awful lot of our referrals from the job center. And so we have a decent relationship with them. And we understand that Marathon has no employees involved with the closure that was announced last week. In our conversations with ConocoPhillips, we understand that they're doing their best right now to take care of their own and find other opportunities for many of their employees that may be affected by the closure, as well as Peak and Udelhoven. We understand that the real number is closer to 30 right now, and that number may change the more they have an opportunity to seek other opportunities for their employees. We will keep in close contact with the Peninsula delegation, and my regional manager in Kenai has already contacted the local offices in Kenai. In addition to helping employees, one of our responsibilities in the department is to work with employers, and so we've already done a little bit of research on the occupations that are involved. Operators, roustabouts, and instrument technicians are the primary occupations that are being affected by this. And right now, we have a lot of jobs listed for those occupations. Schlumberger, Oilfield Services, Marathon, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Energy Services, Tesoro. Especially in the springtime, they will have a lot more job openings for those particular occupations coming up. So the timing may be good for those employees. The Department of Labor has a rapid response team made up of employment and training professionals that are hand chosen in the department statewide to respond to activities such as this during tough decisions, business decisions. And we work primarily with the employer initially because we'd like to meet with the employees at their current place of business. And that includes working with any bargaining units that may represent those employees. Our services include anything from providing information and referrals all the way to what Representative Olson mentioned regarding a transition center. We still have that square footage in the Kenai Job Center for the closure of the Agrium plant and are still working with several of those employees right now. So we do have those kinds of resources still available. We also will work with the company on providing them enough information to perhaps apply for a Trade Adjustment Act application with the federal government, and that would provide them, the employees that are working currently, an opportunity for additional training and employment resources. And that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions from committee members to Mr. Nelson? Mr. Nelson. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much. Can you expand a little bit on the Trade Adjustment Act? Do we have other people falling under that right now in the state, and is that something you've done before?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes. We've actually did a press release not too long ago, maybe several weeks ago, and we have approximately 8,000 residents of the state that are eligible for Trade Adjustment Act services. And the Trade Adjustment Act application is for companies who have gone out of business or been pressed by competition from foreign prices or foreign competition. And that was the original purpose of it.
Thank you. So if I might follow up.
Please, go ahead.
The client is actually the employer, and the services are provided to the employees?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else for the department? Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. All right. At this time, if we could have Dan Clark come to the table. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Please state your name, your title, and if you have a brief opening statement, we got a lot of ground to cover, so go ahead, sir.
Great. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Clark. I'm the manager of the Cook Inlet Assets for ConocoPhillips, Alaska. I have three discussion points to share with you this morning. First, a brief background of the Kenai LNG plant. Second, our recent announcement to ConocoPhillips employees regarding the ceasing of LNG exports. And third, ConocoPhillips commitments as we move through this process. First, on background, the Kenai LNG plant has been operating for 41 years is currently the only significant industrial user of natural gas in South Central Alaska. The Kenai LNG plant received a new two-year export license on October 5th, 2010, which will expire on March 31st, 2013. We're appreciative of the resolution that you supported last year on the extension and regret that market conditions do not support continued operation of the plant. The plant is jointly owned by ConocoPhillips and Marathon. With respect to the announcement to the recent announcement to employees, we did announce that the plant will be ceasing LNG exports effective about April or May of this year. That market conditions have deteriorated such that continued operation of the facility for LNG exports is not commercially viable. ConocoPhillips will continue to operate both the Beluga River unit and the North Cook Inlet unit fields, and staff at those facilities will remain. Following the last export cargo, ConocoPhillips will take steps to preserve the plant for future options, and these options might include exports for natural gas being delivered from the North Slope to South Central Alaska via a pipeline, or a reconfiguration of the plant to serve as an import facility if that's needed. With respect to our commitments going forward, we will be working with all affected employees to look for other opportunities within the company. We also currently have two firm supply contracts with Chugach Electric and one non-firm supply contract with NSTAR, and ConocoPhillips is committed to continue to honor these gas supply contracts, our commitments under those. In closing, I'd just like to say that Kenai LNG plant has been safely and efficiently exporting LNG to markets in Japan for these last 41 years, and when needed, diverting gas supply to the local utilities. The plant has played a key role in our company's history, as well as the history of the Kenai Peninsula. We're proud of that history, and we are thankful to the many employees and stakeholders for their many contributions in that notable history. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you and the other committee members gathered here today for this opportunity to speak with you, and I'm now available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. I guess you talked about preserving the plant. Does that mean a warm or cold mothballing?
If the plant will be mothballed, that terminology, I guess, can be interpreted in ways that basically the plant's in good condition. We intend to maintain it, keep it in good condition such that if another one of these other options came about, that it could be, you know, utilized in expeditious fashion.
Okay. Representative Keller.
On the reconfiguration option that you bring up, I've heard speculation that it's no big deal, and I was wondering if you have can give us some kind of idea what would be involved if we if that option you know, happened as a stopgap while we're working on something else. I mean, what would be entailed in the reconfiguration of the plant for an import?
Representative Keller, through the chair. Essentially, obviously, the plant's been liquefying, storing into tanks, and exporting through tankers. Essentially, what would happen to reconfigure, and I'm presuming you're asking about in an import scenario, you know, obviously those tankers could pull up to that same dock. There'd have to be some piping modifications to allow for the flow of LNG to flow from the dock back to the tanks. So there'd be piping modifications associated with that. And then, obviously, the LNG would be still stored in those tanks. And then, at times, if that LNG were needed for the local market, what would need to happen is facilities would have to be installed that could take the LNG out of the tanks, heat it up, and vaporize it into a gas form, and be able to put it into the pipelines that are located nearby. So that's the kind of basic scope of work that would need to be done.
So. Before I go to Representative Gardner, so following that train of thought is then if there's a rumor out there about you selling it, that would be quelled, because it sounds like I know that ConocoPhillips thinks 50, 60, 70, 80 years out. So you're thinking that its future may be importing the LNG?
Well, certainly it's been talked about by the utilities. We know that may be needed, and I think, you know, our intention is to preserve it for that option if that's what's needed, or if exports come about again in the future.
Okay. Representative Gardner, you had a question?
Yes, thank you very much. You said that market conditions didn't support continued operation, which, as I understand it, the Trade Adjustment Act would sort of require that kind of thing, and I hope that that's true. But do you think, or maybe it's a speculation, but do you think that had you been able to get a 10-year export license, locking in the price a couple years ago for the next 10 years, do you think you would have been able to fulfill that contract, or do you think that the Japanese would have looked elsewhere for cheaper gas?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, that's a very difficult question to speculate on what would have happened under different conditions. What I do know is the last two renewals of the license have been, you know, two-year increments, and that's what we've had to deal with. Other scenarios are pretty hard to speculate on.
Thank you.
Debbie, just for the record, the House is co-chair of resources. Eric Feige is in the room as well. Please note that for the record. Mr. Clark, maybe a tough question. You know, I'm sure your company is out there trying to get these contracts renewed for whatever length of time that you had available. How did the state help in that? I mean, was the governor and any of his employees working hand in hand with you to get those contracts renewed?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, we've been in this business for a long time. We've renewed contracts over time have had this business for 41 years, and I would say the primary support that we received was when we went through the last export license, you know, seeking that the two-year license from April of this year through March of 2013. We received support as we went through that process. But with respect to marketing our LNG, or that was the company's that was in our arena that we were working that. So there was no direct interaction with the state regarding marketing of our LNG, if that's the question.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't reject any support from the state on.
I had no interaction, Mr. Chairman.
So we could ask the vice chair about maybe the local workers and the local residents saw this coming, but how about the rest of the state? How about state government? Did we see it coming?
Mr. Chairman, are you asking me that question?
Yes.
I Don't know. I mean, we obviously we sought the license extension, and our intent was pursuing to try to find contracts for that, and you were unable to get those commercial arrangements in place. I don't know how others might have seen it.
Okay. Well, later in during this hearing, we will ask RCA to come up and talk about some of the decisions that are made. But I guess. I don't see no other questions at the moment. So we've talked about what options we have for this gas now. What's going to happen when in the summer when the demand is much lower?
Mr. Chairman, so obviously if the plant had been open, gas would have been exported. That was the whole basis of seeking the license extension to be able to export LNG. And with the plant ceasing export operations, the gas that would have gone there will be restricted and will have to be, controlled or shut in fields. So there will be gas production shut in as a result of this.
Okay. Representative Olson, please.
Most of your assets are older assets. And if you shut them in, what are the likelihood of them coming back at some point in time in the future?
Representative Olson, through the chair. We're taking a close look, obviously, at our production. Right, both of these fields, both the Blue River unit and the North Cook Inlet unit, have been on production for 40-plus years since the late 60s. And so as we look at what production we might have to restrict or reduce, we'll be identifying those wells that have the least risk. With these wells, particularly later in life, as you mentioned, water production tends to increase. And when you shut in a well with water production, there is risk that when you want to turn it back on, that it won't necessarily be there, that you might have to have some intervention work. So we'll be working hard to manage that the best we can to minimize the impact of that. And so that when, more production or more deliveries are needed as the temperature gets colder, that those volumes will be there.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Clark, okay, let's just say something magical happens and it's in a warm mothball, and you can restart it because you found a new contract. Could you just tell us in ballpark figures what that would cost to restart it up? I mean, it must be a major investment.
Mr. Chairman, so this will be a scenario where the plant shut down for some period of time and then start back up. I think that it would really depend on the scenario of what the future looked like with that. If it was another long-term export scenario, some long-term gas supply, there would need to be some renewal in the plant. The plant's 40 years old, and particularly the turbines that are there. Would probably need to be replaced. So there would need to be some significant investment associated with that. If it was depending on when it happened, if it was a short-term type situation, which would be tougher to make happen, but, we would have to assess the facilities at that time to see what would need to be done. But certainly another long-term export scenario would require some significant investment.
Any guess at what that would cost you?
Well, it would probably depend on when it happened, but it's, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Hundreds of?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, anyone, usually Representative Tuck has questions, but you can jump in any time.
Okay.
But I guess within that debate of shutting it down and then restarting it, would it take a significant scenario or what?
Mr. Chairman, it'll depend on what those conditions are at that time, how much gas might be available and for how long, and we'll have to look at what the condition of the plant is, how we've maintained it. There's a lot of different factors that will go into that, so it's difficult to speculate on that.
Okay, one final question, and I'll go to my colleagues here, is, obviously there's been a lot of talk about bringing in newcomers into the gas, look at the Cook Inlet gas field. So does this have an impact on those plans, for example, the jackup rig?
Mr. Chairman, well, again, I'd be speculating on others' behalf, but without, if to the extent people would be looking for gas, this is, you know, a market that isn't there, that was there before. So presumably that could have an impact on how they view, you know, their economics of what they're pursuing. But if they're pursuing oil, that would be a different scenario. I wouldn't expect that this would have much impact on that.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does ConocoPhillips have any other LNG plants across the world that it sells into different markets?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, yes, we have a facility in Northern Australia and that sells into the Asia-Pacific markets. We also have recently started up another one of the LNG trains in Qatar. So, those are at least two I can think of, and I'm not sure if there are others. I think we have ownership in several others, but we don't operate.
Yes, go ahead.
And if I might, Mr. Clark, then have you secured contracts that were viable and economical from ConocoPhillips' perspective in those markets?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair. Yeah, those particular contracts would have been done at different times. You know, all these contracts get done, and it's on the market conditions at that time. And so those have been very, very significant investments within the last five years or so. And so those have been long-term arrangements that have been put in place with buyers.
I might, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
And those contract periods were for how long?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, I don't know exactly, but they're going to be on the order of 20 years or something like that, something very long to justify the very large investments that were needed.
And do you have any idea on where those contracts were secured at, in which markets? You referred to the Asian market, which this particular LNG plant exported to also?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, I don't know precisely where all those go, although I believe, you know, Asia is definitely, Japan in particular, is the largest user, so there's at least significant portions that go to that market.
So then finally, how do we stack up then for the closure on this? Were our operating costs more expensive than the other markets? Were there increased transportation costs that affected the closure in this particular scenario?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, I think obviously we've exported for 40 plus years, have been, you know, competitive. When we started exporting, we were the only supplier to Japan. And if you look at last year's numbers, we were less than about 0.5% of that supply. So their market has obviously increased significantly as our volumes have come down somewhat, although we're a fairly small supplier overall in the market. In terms of how our costs would project, there's really multiple components when we look at the economics of the business climate associated with this. It's the pricing that you could receive for the LNG. It's also the volumes that would go through the plant. There's lower the volumes, lower the efficiencies in the plant. So there's multiple factors that go into an evaluation of sort of the commercial viability of the plant. I think I could generally say that the smaller the plant, the higher the cost per unit. Bigger plants have a greater scale. So.
Yes.
Mr. Clark, then, are you saying that in comparison to the other assets that are held by ConocoPhillips, that this is a smaller production unit, just based on the reduction in contracts that you've been able to secure around the world?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, this plant has a capacity of about 230 million cubic feet a day, and it, relative to the plants that have been built in more recent times, is an order of magnitude less. So it's much, much more. At the time, it was a first, basically a first of its kind and significant size. But nowadays, plants are built much bigger.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
Does the taxing structure have anything to do with the formula for your return on investment that caused this particular asset to be closed versus trying to secure in another market?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair. Taxes are an element. I mean, it's definitely, when you look at the value of the production, it is an economic component. I will say that taxes are very low in the Cook Inlet, so it wasn't as if the tax system here was a hindrance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before I go to Representative Keller, just so I mean, you can be as articulate as you want, but some have characterized this as a silver lining. Do you agree?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what their perspective would be. I think what I would say is that we certainly articulated a lot of benefits of keeping the plant open, particularly as you move into these colder winter months and the ability to divert volumes and having production online. There's significant benefit to having those that production already flowing instead of flowing directly into the plant. It could turn at a time of need and go into the local market. With the ceasing of the operation, that won't be there. So I think that could could create it's an additional challenge to meet local needs. Certainly the jobs and taxes and everything else that went with the facility will be lost as well. So what I would say is I think there's many benefits to the plant operating. Having the plant not operate is difficult for me to see any significant benefit associated with that.
Representative Keller.
I hate asking questions that expose my ignorance, but I'm going to give it a shot here. Baffles me is we're looking at a shortage, in the supply to the South Central, and yet we're shutting down producing wells, and I if you'd help me understand, why. I mean, you're connected to the grid, right, the supply grid, mm-hmm. And so it just the massive size of the LNG export operation, it's supply and demand, and I'm just trying to help you understand.
Representative Keller, through the chair, let me give that a shot. The local market in South Central Alaska is highly cyclical, so demand on a warm summer day might be 12 times less than it is on a cold winter day. Okay, so I think when maybe you hear about wells might be shut in, it's going to be during that time of low demand. So there's literally nowhere to go with the gas. There's no place for it to go. And I think to the extent you may hear about potential shortfalls or concerns about that, that's going to be on those peak winter days. And so at that point in time, everything that can flow to the local market more than likely will be. But it's not as if you can take a molecule of gas in the summer and apply it to that winter peak demand. Now, there is a project that's being pursued by NSTAR and others to put in a underground storage facility. And what that project, it is proceeding ahead, to my knowledge, but what that project will allow is when it's an underground reservoir where gas could be injected into in the summer, and gas taken back out in the winter during times of need, what that project will do will help flatten out that demand so that if there is excess deliverability in the summer, production could flow into that storage facility and then the utilities could pull it out in that time of the winter. But until that storage facility is in place, that capability is not there.
To the chair, follow up.
I was under the impression, and again, I have been following it real close, but I was under the impression that that was in place or about to be.
Representative Keller, through the chair, let me clarify that there is some producer-owned underground storage. Marathon has a reservoir. Chevron has a couple of smaller ones as well. So there is some storage that they use for their proprietary purposes to help them meet their contracts. This third-party sort of more open access storage is not anticipated to be in place until, I think, at best the summer of 2012. So while that project is moving ahead, there's investment that has to be made, wells that have to be drilled, compression that has to be installed. All those things have to be done before that facility is up and working.
Thank you for helping me understand.
Okay. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The contract that ConocoPhillips has, was that a single contract with a customer?
Representative Tuck, are you referring to the LNG sales contract?
Yes, the LNG sales. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tuck, through the chair. The current contract that's in place to sell LNG is a joint contract, Marathon and ConocoPhillips. We jointly sell LNG to Tokyo Electric and Tokyo Gas. And as was mentioned, Tokyo Electric and Tokyo Gas have been the purchasers of the LNG since the inception. So So we've had a very long relationship with those buyers.
And Mr. Chair, and that was over the whole period of 41 years. Did you have any other customers other than them?
Representative Tuck, there through the chair, there was a single cargo that was sold to a facility in Sockland to help them start up their facility, help them kind of prime the facility for startup. So there was one cargo that went there, and that was several years ago. But absent that, every other cargo has gone to Tokyo Electric and Tokyo Gas.
And then one final question, Mr. Chair. The contracts that Tokyo Gas and Electric has now, what's the duration of those contracts?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, those contracts over time have matched the export license. In other words, they've matched up with the amount of time that ConocoPhillips and Marathon have had the right to export LNG. And so this particular contract that we're in now started in April of 2009 and expires next month.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
I meant with the current, other than ConocoPhillips, because they're getting their gas from somewhere, what's the shortest duration of contracts that they have with their other customers, or do you know that?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I'm sorry I didn't understand your question. I don't know. I think we're definitely on the short end of those contracts. I do believe they, from time to time, do buy spot cargoes if they have need. Typically, they like to secure their supply for longer periods of time.
And, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. You know, I can't help but to wonder if, you know, these two-year increments, it's hard to prepare a plant and keep a plant going and be able to forecast and do the necessary improvements and then be able to lock in contracts, you know, with only a two-year period each time. It's too bad that we're not able to get a longer license for that export facility. But thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll continue on this, and then briefly here very soon we'll let you get up from the seat. But first, Representative Keller, then Representative Gardner, then I'll have a closing question.
Thank you, Mr. Do you have do you pay taxes on the reserve once the well is shut down? That gas that is there that is counted on your books as reserves. Do you have to pay taxes on that? And then, how does that, is that, if so, how does that play in? I mean,
Representative Keller, through the chair, I believe we pay production taxes when we produce from the well. So I don't believe, if production doesn't come out of the well, I don't believe there's any taxes paid associated with that.
Thanks.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Do you know if ConocoPhillips has gas contracts with Tokyo Gas, Tokyo Electric, by the company names, right, mm-hmm. from gas produced elsewhere than Cook Inlet?
Representative Gardner, through the chair. Yes, some of the, from the facility that I referenced earlier in Australia, mm-hmm. At least some of those volumes go to Tokyo Electric and Tokyo Gas.
Thank you.
I believe this will be the final question, Mr. Clark, is over the last few years, there's been a lot of political currency and a lot of effort about gas storage developments. So how does this closure affect those, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, I think in the past several winters, the LNG plant has acted as sort of virtual storage in that sense, to be able to help meet that peak need in the winter, rather than an underground storage facility where you inject into it and then pull back out. Gas has been flowing into the LNG plant, and then at the time of need has been able to be redirected. That capability won't be there next winter. It's in place right now, obviously, as we're operating. I would say it probably highlights the urgency with which you want to proceed with people would want to proceed with that project.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So the intent is to go till 11:30 if we need to. So at this time, we're going to go into the fourth part of our hearing, and that's South Central Energy Supply. And that allows Janet Wilson, are you online?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this is Janice Wilson.
Yes, I know you're available for questions, but you've heard a couple of questions. Unless you have a presentation, you're welcome to answer those questions if you
Well, let me just start by saying that the RCA has no regulatory authority at all over the LNG plant or over any transactions that the LNG plant does. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has recently, in the last few years, asserted jurisdiction over the LNG plant, which they never had before in the history of the plant. The Department of Energy, of course, has the regulatory jurisdiction to approve or not approve the export permit to allow LNG to leave the country. We are concerned with the closure of the LNG plant by our concern is referred concern from our utilities. Our utilities have been, as Mr. Clark has stated, they have had the availability of gas from the LNG plant to cover them during the coldest periods of the winter, and from our point of view, that's the most critical element that we see in the closing of this plant from our point of view. And I'm available for questions.
Ask a question to you. Representative Wilson, please.
No, I think more a statement. No, I'll pass.
Ms. Wilson, I guess I'll bring it up again. In the opening statement by my vice chair, they talked about the long decision-making process, several years, related to gas in South Central. You have a comment on that?
The process we go through when approving gas contracts is completely dependent upon whether those contracts are contested by people who want to become parties before us and go through a litigated hearing. In the event that there are no protests of the gas contract, they are approved fairly routinely and quickly. So it is not something that we have had within our control, the timing of that. We do have statutory timelines as to how long it can last, and those have been in place since 2003, I believe.
So, Ms. Wilson, just to follow that, so as far as the South Central energy supply, is it a problem in your mind? Is it, and what's being done by the producers, the utilities, and the RCA? What's going on?
I think that's probably better answered by the utilities than by the RCA. We don't go out and contract for gas. They do that. We are the approving body once the gas is contracted for.
So you're an impartial observer to all this?
I suppose you could say that, yes.
Representative Faircloth, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I won't be quite as gracious. I served locally on the Anchorage Assembly where we had two different commitments that were before the RCA, and RCA turned both of those down, and I'm not sure that there were any plaintiffs or other parties associated with that. It was RCA directly, and on top of that, I've had an RCA commissioner in my office actually advocating against or for particular movement in a direction of acquiring energy for South Central. So for the two that you denied, I believe one of them involved Marathon that I was more directly associated with. Could you please provide for the committee the name of who might have objected to that? And I'm sure it was based, as I recall, it was based on the RCA determining that the price for the consumer would be too great, and now the consumer is left with nothing.
I'm not, are you saying this was an MLNP contract?
No, ma'am. NSTAR was in front of the RCA as well as other utilities asking to secure contracts for 20 years for South Central on two different occasions, and RCA denied both of those. I'd just like to know on the denial, who was the plaintiff that you were alluding to, other people raising concerns about accepting a gas contract in the South Central area?
The first instance that I will speak about is the 2006 Marathon contract, which was opposed by the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section of the Attorney General's office and by Tesoro, and there was also a consumer involved, and I'm trying to get the list. There were several different people opposing.
Ms. Wilson, when you do have all that information in written form, please forward it to my office, and I'll distribute it to Representative Faircloth and all the other committee members.
Certainly.
Follow-up questions, Representative Faircloth?
You made it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I've got one comment.
Representative Olson, you have a comment?
Yeah, there was one other factor. We've had 3 years when we've had a serious shortage for anywhere from 6 days to several weeks, and the only reason that we didn't have significant outages is something that I believe the correct phrase is peak shaving, where the shipments going to Japan were short-loaded. They sent them partial shipments with the knowledge and agreement of Tokyo Electric and Tokyo Gas to get us through the rolling times. That was crucial, and it was also voluntary to the best of my knowledge, although I think there were some attempts a couple of years ago, I believe by the RCA and by a previous governor, to mandate that ConocoPhillips do that during the winter, which I believe would have disrupted their contracts. If it's voluntary, it has no impact on the contracts, but I'm sure there are people in the room that have a much better grasp on that than I do, but I believe that's probably the basics of it.
Also online, we have two other people that are listening in, and they're available for questions, but I will extend the courtesy of having them make comment. We have Colleen Starring of NSTAR and Carrie Lockhart of Marathon Oil. Colleen, do you wish to make comment at this time?
This is Colleen Starring from NSTAR Natural Gas. I could comment on the contracts, Mr. Chair, that I believe Representative Faircloth mentioned. There was one contract with Marathon that was for a 10-year period of time that would have provided NSTAR all of the deliverability and gas until 2016. And as Commissioner Wilson referenced, the parties that objected in that docket were Tesoro, RAPA, and I believe that the actual commission vote on that contract was a 3-2 vote. Three commissioners did not favor the contract, and two did, and primarily because that contract at that time was tied to a Henry Hub pricing mechanism. Subsequently, there was another Conoco and a Marathon contract that were not approved in the 2007-2008 time frame that went out, I believe, 5 years. And so since then, we've had much shorter contracts. Not all of the deliverability that NSTAR's customers need in the wintertime covered, and different pricing scenarios in order to try to obtain that gas for our customers during the peak winter months.
Okay. Thank you, Colleen. Carrie Lockhart, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Do you wish to make any comments at this time?
Yeah, you know, I'll just state that, you know, I think we all recognize the plant has had a long and important history in Alaska, and its closure inherently difficult on the plant employees, their families, and the community. And for Marathon, I will state that we're strategically invested in storage, and operational mechanisms over recent years to provide the sufficient flexibility in our system so that our operations are not impacted by this. And our number one priority, besides safety and environmental performance, is to make sure that our contractual obligations are met. And supply was certainly one of the factors in the business case that led us to determine that the decision to cease exports was in our best interest so that we could effectively continue to meet these contractual obligations. So that's my statement. That's all I have to add, unless there are specific questions regarding Marathon.
Questions for Carrie on Marathon? No, I appreciate your comments. So I think we're going to wrap it up here pretty quickly. I'd like to ask Mr. Clark to come back up, give you a chance to essentially answer one question, and then maybe now that you've heard several people talk about this situation, maybe a closing remark. But the question is which I neglected to ask you, is there was a question about turning it an import. You've answered that. Is there any chance that you might consider selling the plant to the utilities that use that product?
Mr. Chairman, our intent right now is to get the plant secured, keep it open for those options that could occur. We don't have any particular intent to do that at this time, but if somebody approaches with an offer, we would obviously consider it like we would on anything else.
Okay. Representative Gardner, have a question, please?
And what about the possibility of using the storage facilities?
Representative Gardner, are you referring to the LNG tanks?
Yes.
Okay. The LNG tanks would, the only way that those could be utilized to help meet South Central gas needs at this point would be to have those regasification, basically the heaters put in place to allow to take the LNG out of the tanks and then heat it up into back into a gas form. Those investments would have to be made and to make that happen. So there's not a capability right now to do that.
Thank you.
All right, I'll extend one final sort of wrap-up of maybe other comments that you heard, and then please go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I think I understood all the comments that were made by the various people who testified or made comments. Certainly, Carrie highlighted there might have been a slightly different perspective from Marathon than there may have been from ConocoPhillips, because they do own storage, whereas ConocoPhillips does not, so there is maybe a slight difference in that. But I think given that, I mean, we do regret that this is happening, but it's the reality that we face, that it's just not commercially viable for us, and we're going to do everything we can to help those affected employees. That's our commitment, and to meet these local supply commitments that we have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. That'll conclude this portion of it, and we're going to take just a couple minutes and get ready for House Bill 67 discussion. Bill 67, and because the CS wasn't ready, we're just going to talk about the amendments, and then we'll deal with the amendments and the CS on Thursday. So this will be a very brief rest of the meeting. So in front of you, there's a mistake. It's Representative Foster has 356/A2, amendment number 2. Representative Foster, if you could just speak to the amendment. We're not going to take any action on it, but.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of this amendment would be to increase the credit from 2% to 4% for the rural area incentive. And the purpose of that would be it's hard enough trying to get, I think, the industry to come to Alaska, us being so far away, and the cost of that. And I think it's even harder to get them out to rural Alaska, the operational cost, transportation, logistical issues that this presents. So our hope would be that we could increase the tax incentive from 2% to 4%. I think out in rural Alaska, the great need for economic development If I had my way, I would make that 20%, but being realistic, I think 4% is probably reasonable. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And then on 356 of access A3, amendment number 3, Representative Wilson, can you speak to this amendment for me?
Pardon me?
The amendment, just on the record, we're just a discussion. We're not going to take action on it, but the amendment that, amendment number 3.
This amendment would increase the population to 6,500 from 5,500.
And just for the committee, there are, there's a couple other communities that maybe even a little larger than that that could maybe use the help, and so we'll talk about that on Thursday as well. So these are the two amendments we have. Again, the CS wasn't ready, and we have time. We do have three people that have signed up to testify, and we may ask the Deputy Commissioner Thayer to come up and be available for questions. So at this time, we're going to go to Anchorage. I'm sorry, Pete, I won't try to attempt your name. You could please go on the record, state your name, affiliation, and begin your brief testimony.
Good morning. My name is Pete Calamaritis, and I am representing myself. I was the local captain on the movie Everybody Loves Whales, which had a crew of 30 to 40 at the peak. And I'm in favor of the extension of the bill and the amendment that's currently you mentioned this morning, because that for later in the year, this movie that I participated in appeared to be a very good economic stimulus for Anchorage. In addition to that, we were very well received by all the people that we encountered, both in the grocery stores or vendors that we talked to when we acquired different products and services that was needed to conduct the movie.
Pete, is there any questions for Pete? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Do we have anybody else online? On the offnets? Okay. We do have a couple of people on offnets. Cindy Draper, are you available?
Yes. My name is Cindy Draper. I am the rentals manager for ABC Motorhome, and we rented motorhomes to both Ghost Vision and Everybody Loves Whales for a little over 1,500 additional days that we would not have had at this time of year. So at a price of at around $100 per day, that's a significant boost to, you know, a fairly small company. So we are definitely in favor of extending the tax credits.
Okay, any questions for Cindy? Seeing none. Ted Smith, are you available? Ted Smith, are you available? Okay, well, if we can get him hooked up, we'll take his testimony. Okay. Is there anyone else in the available? Anyone in the room wish to testify on House Bill 67? Okay. Please come forward, state your name, affiliation, and we have a few minutes for your testimony.
For the record, my name is Bryce Habiger. Good evening, or good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I am a Alaskan, born and raised, and I went to college in Chicago, graduated with a degree in film in 2008, testified in support of SB 230 because I believe that it would create jobs here in the state of Alaska, and then I believe over the last year we have seen some of those jobs. Locally, even though I'm based here in Juneau, locally I did production scouting for Everybody Loves Whales. And I also worked as a grip on Ghost Vision, flew up to Anchorage for that work. I believe here in the state, we can, with this bill, grow a crew base that rivals any other base, any other state. That's something that we need to have in place, a crew base that is technically proficient, knowledgeable, yada, yada, so on and so forth. And you see the private sector stepping up and doing that with Alaska Crew Training Incorporated, a nonprofit. And then myself, I've been asked to teach a class to the Lower Kuskokwim District, myself and other filmmakers around the state, to students from the Lower Kuskokwim District about the filmmaking and how to get involved. And that's all I have.
I appreciate any questions for. Yes, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to know, I don't know if you're involved in, at AFN, a number of the students have put together some short films which were very impressive, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you're involved in that.
I'm not, no.
Okay. Well, anything that can be done, you know, in areas that could use a little boost is certainly appreciative, and I've seen the work that some of the students on the Lower Yukon have done in some projects. As I mentioned, they're presented for the AFN annual conference there, and so anyway, thank you for what you do out in rural Alaska.
Yes. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the two productions that you were involved in, mm-hmm. How long did that keep you busy?
Being that I'm based here in Juneau for the present, I worked probably about a week or so on Everybody Loves Whales. It was pretty minimal work, but I was in Juneau. I received a check from them. I didn't have to fly out of this portion of the state, and I flew up to Anchorage to work for about a week on Ghost Vision.
And Representative Tuck.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And graduating in 08, did you come right back to Alaska right away, or did you were you pursuing your career path elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And actually, it's something really close to my heart is all my classmates, they all thought L.A. was the promised land, and they all, you know, took off to go there to try to get jobs there. And I decided that I wanted to start my career here in Alaska. And I didn't know about this piece of legislation, SB 230, before I came back. And so I arrived, and literally like a week later, I was approached by Kate Tessar. She said, "This is what we're trying to get started. You want to help us?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely." And so here I am trying, and I believe successfully so far, to start a career here in Alaska.
Quick comment.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully your friends in L.A. will find out that this is the promised land up
yes.
in Alaska. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We seem to get more and more people that have signed up to testify online. And if other members need to go off to other commitments, please go ahead, and then I'll just take testimony until the end. So at this time, we'll try Ted Smith again.
Hello, this is Ted Smith of Guyana. I was on the movie On the Ice, filmed up in Barrow. We went down to Sundance Film Festival in the end of January. I received excellent reviews from The Hollywood Reporter, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Alaska Dispatch. I'm actually on a plane right now, but I'm in favor of the bill. I live in the village of Kiana, where I think it's extremely important because during the question and answer period after the premiere of the movie at Sundance Film Festival in Park City, a lot of people that I spoke with there were really, I think, their eyes open to what our culture is about. I think it's very important for rural Alaska that these opportunities be available to introduce our culture and show them what it's about. And not only that, I, you know, like I said, the reviews were excellent.
Any questions? Any questions for Ted? Well, Ted, best of luck on your career, and hope there's many more starring roles. Okay.
Excuse me?
Best of luck in the rest of your career in the movies.
I'm sorry. I'm on a small plane right now.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Let's move on to Gary Zimmerman.
Hello. Hi, Chair and committee members. I appreciate the time. Gary Zimmerman. I'm with Avis Rent-A-Car here, based out of Anchorage. I'm the general manager for Avis Rent-A-Car in the state of Alaska. We have 110 employees and 12 locations across the state, and we are in favor of House Bill 67. And I think, just a side note, I think everybody can understand the impact of bringing a film like Everybody Loves Wells or Ghost Visions to a location, the trickle-down economy that happens between people with makeup and hair and food and electricians and personnel. But one of the things, we were a benefit of the of business from Everybody Loves Wales and of Ghost Visions. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to make a point of is that we also are a state tax collector. I like to refer myself as sometimes, but we have a 10% state vehicle rental tax. And I know the young lady that testified earlier with the motorhome company will probably testify to the same, that some of that revenue that we see or is being generated does go back directly into the state in the form of that state vehicle rental tax. And places such as Anchorage, and they also benefit, the municipalities benefit from these rental taxes and the hotel bed taxes, and a lot of the communities throughout the state that have general sales taxes, they will also see increased revenues from events or activities that are associated with the film industry. So we're in favor. We think that Alaska needs to basically, diverse its economy, and the way to do that is through a long-term commitment to the film industry so they can get some basic infrastructure put to place. So be open to any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Gary. And obviously, this is the first stop on several stops in the legislature. So when it gets to finance, your comments might be appropriate at that time. So I appreciate that. I'm seeing no questions for Gary. Let's move on to Maya. Are you available?
Yes, good morning. How are you? How's everyone?
Very good. Please state your name and your affiliation and begin your testimony, please.
Certainly. My name is Maya Salganik, and I'm an assistant professor of film and video arts at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, as well as the director of our film studies program here. As such, I have a wonderful responsibility to help guide our next generation of filmmakers, directors, students interested in working in the film industry from our state. The University of Alaska Board of Regents will be reviewing a proposal this week to begin a Bachelor of Arts degree program in film. We should know by the end of the week if this program will be implemented. And it wouldn't be implemented until 2013. But since testifying on behalf of the establishment of the State Film Office, Senate Bill 230, 3 years ago, we have seen an amazing growth in film in this state and have been able to place students with all sorts of organizations, from Discovery Channel to the Sundance Institute, Universal Pictures, CNN, History Channel, and dozens of smaller film companies from all over the world. Our students have worked on television commercials to feature films. We've received funding from the National Science Foundation. We've worked with the International Polar Year. Our students were recognized by the legislature last year for their work as broadcast journalists in Iraq. We've assisted with film shoots all the way from Anchorage to Barrow, and it's just continuing to grow. In terms of student enrollment, our UAF film program and all of the courses we offer has grown 60% in enrollment in the last 4 years, and we're continuing to see that growth. These tax incentives are the very first step that industry looks to deciding where they're going to put their workers, where they're going to bring their film. And without the incentive program, the long-term growth of our industry is not going to thrive. The University of Alaska will hopefully commit itself to helping maintain this long-term growth with this Bachelor of Arts program in film. And steps will need to be taken in the meantime to help crew up all of the film companies as they're needed right now. It does take several years, as we all know, to develop a film production from concept to screen, and we've only really seen 2 years to prove what our state film office can do. Extending this incentive program is going to solidify our ability to really bring a full force infrastructure into the state.
Okay, thank you, Maya. Is there, I see no questions from the committee members. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go back to this room. Greg Kessler, are you available for testimony? Please state your name, your affiliation, and provide your comments to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Greg Kessler, and I'm the Alaska Commercial Director for Total Motion Trailer Express, Inc. I'm here today to testify in support of the reauthorization of the Alaska Film Incentive Program. From a TOTE perspective, just this past year, we had the pleasure of shipping cargo for two productions, one, Icebreaker Films and the Everybody Loves Whales movie, and for Ghost Vision Films. In fact, we moved a combination of 35 separate shipments, both northbound and some 33 separate shipments southbound for these movie shoots. These were a combination of tractor-trailer units, another cargo consisting of variety from animatronics, whales, to a honey wagon, and most everything in between. Today, TOTE is involved in the planning and preparation for future shipments related to the industry. TOTE wasn't just a direct benefactor. Several of our customers and vendors, we've heard one earlier, like Avis Rental Cars and ABC Motorhomes and Weaver Brothers Trucking, provided support for the film industry also. The reauthorization of the Alaska Film Tax Credits will go a long way to make Alaska an attractive place for the film industry, and will continue to bring new business opportunities and diversify those business opportunities to the emerging Alaska film industry. I thank you and am open for any questions.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come by and testify. Is there any questions, comments from committee members? Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just a quick comment.
Oh, please go ahead, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With 35 shipments northbound, only 32 going southbound, that means they must have left some stuff behind for Alaskans up here.
Exactly. They must have consumed some of it here, yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe this is the last person signed up to testify. Karen, are you online?
Hello.
Yes. Please state your full name, your affiliation, and provide your comments to the committee, please.
Yes. Hi. My name is Karen Talent, and I'm a studio teacher. And I worked most recently on Everybody Loves Whales, Ghost Vision, and a few segments of Sarah Palin's Alaska. And just to tell you a little bit what a studio teacher does, it's state law that says anytime you employ minors in the entertainment industry, you have to have a studio teacher. I provide not only the education for the kids involved in the different productions, but I also make sure that the child labor laws are being followed. And I'm on set with the kids, and I'm making sure that it's a safe working environment. So I'm testifying today on behalf of extending Alaska's Film Incentive Program. Being a part of Whales and Ghost Vision, I saw firsthand the impact that the film industry has for our state. It provides jobs for Alaska crew. It provides economic opportunities for Alaska businesses, and film and television projects offer invaluable marketing promotion for Alaska tourism products and businesses. Until our film incentive program that was passed several years ago, I always had to have a full-time teaching job, but because of the increased interest of filming in Alaska, I can now be a studio teacher full-time, which is a wonderful thing for me because of our film incentive program. It's increased that interest in our state, and it's all about money. 45 other states have incentive programs in place because they see the economic benefit that the film industry provides for the labor force and the businesses and communities around the state. Canada and other countries also provide incentive programs. So it's important for us to have a viable, competitive program to bring productions here to our state. I saw how many Alaskan crew were employed on whales. There was at least 100 crew. You know, there were over 2,000 Alaskans as far as speaking roles and extras. And working with all the different people every day, like the costumer for the young man that I worked with so closely, you know, they would tell me about going to Chena Hot Springs or going to Girdwood or going to the different restaurants in town or going to the different shops and buying souvenirs to take home to family and friends. One of the hot dog vendors was hired one day to feed crew. We were filming later into the evening, and so even the hot dog vendor got business from Everybody Loves Whales. So it's just crucial if we want to continue to be a viable industry, and it's an industry that provides, it's a multi-million dollar industry, and like I said, it's a great way to diversify our economy and provide the jobs for jobs and money for businesses and to increase the tourism here in our state. And I just feel that it's a huge win-win for Alaska, and it's all about the money and where the producers are going to get the most bang for their buck. So having this extending the film incentive program can only continue to grow this viable film industry and bring millions of dollars to our state.
Okay, Karen, thank you for your comments. I see no questions from committee members. No one else has signed up to testify from the public, but we do have Juanetta Ayers and the deputy commissioner here from Commerce. Do you wish to make comment before we adjourn until Thursday? No comments at this time. The intent of the chair is to present the CS will be presented to your respective staffs and offices with all the amendments, and we'll take action on Thursday. And unless there's a hiccup, we plan to send it out Thursday. Debbie, we're adjourned at 11:45.